is the Lombardi Line with Stormy Bonatoni and Mike Palm on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
Welcome in, everybody. Friday edition of the Lombardi Line from downtown Las Vegas and our Circa Sportsbook studio. I'm Ben Wilson in for Stormy. Mike Palm is here, though. It's a Mike Palm Friday, VP of Operations for Circa, the Golden Gate, and the D, fresh off our first preseason game of the year, Mike. Or was it? That's the big way to start. At least we were very locked in. I'm glad that the ESPN broadcast had the wherewithal to realize what was the most, at least interesting, entertaining part of last night's game, which was the kickoffs. Brand new rule, and it was fascinating to watch that in real time for the first time.
I think it would have been interesting to know the number of television sets that were tuned into the game at kickoff and were tuned into the game after the kickoff, because I think many people tuned in just to see the opening kick, and then that was it.
How often do you see, if you go to YouTube, usually the leagues, they all post their, you know, six-minute highlight videos. How often do you ever see or have seen the NFL simply post a separate highlight just for all the kickoffs? But it's well worth going. It's a two-minute video every single kickoff. Bears, quote-unquote, win the game. 21-17 game called due to severe storms in the area late third quarter. Headache for some bettors out there. The vast majority of sports books have the 55-minute rule, Mike. So for those betting at Circa or anywhere else, no action, at least if you had the full game bets. First half bets were graded, though. But full game, we pretend like it didn't exist.
Yeah, it's a distinct minority of books that graded out when things happened there without the game being official. The unfortunate thing is when an over is already hit.
Right.
That's one of the worst beats in baseball, is when you have an over and it could rain in the eighth. Now, we changed the rule here this year at Circa, where as long as it's an official game, even if it's shortened, we're still paying out run line and totals.
So you could have a five-inning
game, you're under, could win. Because we don't want refunds. Books don't want refunds. They want action on the bets. They want decisions. Except Major League Baseball considers that an official game. Obviously, the NFL does not consider short of 55 an official game. But that was the unfortunate part. I think you have to keep that in mind, though. Like, was it last year, 2 years ago, the lights went out? There was a bank of lights. They stopped. Like, they don't any excuse, they're going to stop. It's like an All-Star game. Let's just stop it.
There was the Green Bay game where they looked at the field and they're like, no, we're good. They didn't even play. There were, some books that as action was gradable. So, for instance, once the total reached past the 31 mark, that was graded as an over. But, not a fun experience if you turn the game off at halftime and your ticket was a winner and you wake up today and you find a refund there. Would you think, and you laid out the reason why it's the 55-minute rule, because that is the threshold for an official game in NFL parlance. Would books ever consider changing that language specifically for the preseason, since you have a much higher likelihood of storms? It's August. You generally see it happens. It seems like once a preseason where a game might get called after, say, three quarters, say you make it a 45-minute rule. Not that that would have impacted things, because it only went, 42 minutes last night.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point to consider as you see more of a proliferation of this happening. I have a story that's sort of an aside to this about house rules and that. I bet a international soccer friendly 2 weeks ago, Ben, that happened in Spain.
Okay.
Now, it was well publicized that they were going to play 3 30-minute periods, not 2 45-minute halves because of the extreme heat, and they were going to take 10 minutes between the periods. Game was posted. I made a wager on the game, under 2.5. It was a goal in the 89th minute, 1-0 final. Waiting. Hour later, I got a refund on my bet. So I called the hotline for the book, and I said, I don't understand. They played 90 minutes. They actually, with the three periods and added time, played 97 minutes. They said they didn't. Rule stipulated it must be at least 40 minutes in each half, and they didn't play halves. I said, well, that was well known. Why would you put the game up on the board? And they said, well, we shouldn't have put it up, but you don't have a bet. You don't satisfy the house rules. So I was a little perturbed.
I would be perturbed as well. It'd be one thing if you would bet a first half and tried to get away with it on that side.
But that's the game, a 90
but
minutes
you were betting,
of soccer.
And you said, with the stoppage time, you probably had to deal more.
I did. I had to deal with three
probably
stoppage
Probably the plus
times.
EV play would have been over, simply because,
Anyhow. But
different periods. Yeah, alas. That's a long way of saying.
Sometimes knowing the house rules isn't all that's in it. Yeah. But it comes up, and then, Jeff Benson says, we refund it. And, of course, there's some other book that paid out, and then it gets into all this and that, but know the house rules is always the bottom line.
And that storms are a possibility in the Midwest in the month of August. We might know a thing or two about that. On the show today, Jonathan Alexander from the Houston Chronicle. He will give us his insights, at least as far as some of the players who showed out last night, who could actually be difference makers, or at least on the opening day roster for the Houston Texans. Jeff will join us. Jonathan will join us, I should say, coming up in a half hour. Jeff Kerr from CBS Sports NFL writer, also covers the Philadelphia Eagles, joins us in hour number two. That is coming up 2:15 Eastern time. As far as the actual game last night, what we did see, I thought the kickoff, at least from my perspective, having no idea how it actually looked in real time, Mike, was that because of the way the blockers are within that 5-yard stationary period, you really didn't see any ability for the return team's blockers to set up any separation. And the thought is these are either going to be a bunch of 15 to 20 yard returns this year, or you'll see guys break the one line of defense and they're gone. Like, I don't really see a world in which you get like a 40, 50 yard return. It just seems, as much as the NFL wants action on kickoffs, it doesn't seem like there are many possible outcomes based on the way the blockers are set up.
Well, nobody would ever have an angle once they break the line. So to your point, no one's getting tackled at the opponent's 25.
Right.
But also to your point, it, you know, when you see this in the UFL, or it started in the XFL and UFL and all how they do this, the quality of the athletes is obviously a little bit lower. It's hard here to create some separation. I know Michael and I lean to that maybe it's going to produce more touchdowns. But at the end of the day, I don't know that it's going to change the field position for the offense. And if there's nothing exciting out of this and it's just guys running into a group of, I mean, I think we're going to see a world where they just get the ball at the 25 after a touchdown.
Sure. And the league wanted more action on kickoffs. It was 22% amount of kickoffs returned last year, but only one of the, what, half dozen kickoffs was returned past the 30, and it was to about the 31, 32. So you ended up basically having a wash. Now, we'll get used to how it looks aesthetically over time, but I'm with you. It doesn't really change much of a calculus, more than anything. At least I think the bigger rule change is that the NFL finally made the smart decision to allow a third challenge, even if you lose one of your first two, because why should you be penalized for an official's mistake in a situation where you have to challenge? That, to me, was long overdue, and we'll see, you know, how much that impacts things going forward. All I know is, at least in the game itself, for the Chicago Bears, we didn't see any of the starters, nor starting quarterback Caleb Williams as a rookie. At least impressive to see what happened, just pulling up the final box score here, how good Brett Rypien was. And for Tyson Bagent, who was thrust into the spotlight, looked very, very good right away, struggled to duplicate that success going forward. Now, look, this is a Bears offensive line that does have some question marks. You have a previously injured quarterback in college in Caleb Williams. You want to feel confident in your backup, and that should be a legitimate competition, you'd think, Mike, after how good Rypien looked with a lot of backups he was throwing to last night.
Yeah, I would say if you're a Bears fan, you liked what you saw last night. You know, we've made the argument, how low are these totals? They get down to 30. Is it too low? But if you look in the last dozen years, when they're 35 or lower, they go under. Well, this was way off the mark. But I don't know. If you're not going to play Caleb Williams, I mean, what is the point of preseason anymore? You don't want to get this guy some reps against some guys that will be playing in the NFL. I don't know. It's tough. And it's tough for fans to come out and watch these games, too. I mean, you're better to go to their camps where you're actually going to get to see them scrimmaging against first-team players than what they're putting on as preseason football. I agree, and I hinted at it yesterday with the questions. I think it makes it harder for us to handicap when we get to week one, the state of what the preseason is now.
That's why the Green Bay Packers family night scrimmage, probably more popular than any. I mean, they sell that thing out. It's more popular than preseason games because, you know, A, you're not going to have to sit there for 4 hours potentially. And B, you at least know you'll see some action, even if it's just a bunch of flag football stuff going on. I don't know. You ever read Paper Lion, George Plimpton?
I have, yes.
Great book. I think that's what we should start. That's where a reporter tried to see, could he get in, could he last a play in an NFL preseason game? I think that would be great. We need to get a reporter to do that. Strap on the pads. There might be some liability going on with that. I don't know. I enjoy
trying to think of a reporter. Anyhow.
We'll ask Jonathan Alexander maybe coming up in a little bit. As far as action today, a lot of Olympic talk we'll have later on as we prepare for a really, really big weekend starting tomorrow morning. U.S. with their final, on the men's basketball side, their final group stage matchup, taking on Puerto Rico as giant favorites. We'll also have the U.S. women's soccer team in action, quarterfinal against Japan tomorrow. Olympic tennis, Olympic golf gets into the weekend and the medal rounds as a result. And we'll also have some baseball today here, Mike. It is exciting, at least for the St. Louis Cardinals, who get Eric Fetty making his debut today. Fetty doesn't have to go very far from the White Sox now to Wrigley as the Cardinals take on the Cubs today. That is our day baseball game today against Javier Assad.
Well, if you're a Cardinals fan, you have to be sick about last night.
Yeah. You're hoping to wipe the stink off
quickly. Oh, but it's awful. And you get two outs and you're up 4-3. Even after Bellinger hits the home run, I don't know why he kept going back to curveball after curveball. And you had Swanson missed two pitches by a foot. So maybe the Cubs use this as some momentum here. Assad was great for a year, June to June. Hasn't been so great past that. I thought this was the most underrated pickup and the second best pickup at the trade deadline was Fetty. I just don't know if the Cardinals have enough around him. I think they needed to get three starters. But I think Fetty will be terrific for them. I rank Flaherty as the number one pickup. So a good game today against Assad. I lean first five under here, but I haven't made a play yet.
Yeah, total has seen some action to the over from 7.5 up to 8, at least on that full game. It is a situation where, you know, with the Cardinals, you would think, right, Fetty, 3.11 ERA, advanced numbers indicate he is well-deserving, earning of those numbers, pitching for the worst team in baseball in the White Sox. Now you get a Cub team who has been bottom five since the All-Star break in hitting. I mean, that was really, last night, the comeback win. First time we've seen any life out of a Cub team that you thought, given the state of the NL, still would throw something out there and at least give a final push. But it has been a dead team walking now for some time under manager Craig Counsell. So I really want to get behind Fetty and the Cardinals today. That certainly would be the lean there as basically a pick 'em to slight favorite, about -115 consensus in the market. But St. Louis has left a lot to be desired, especially hitting with runners in scoring position. They've been ultimately streaky with that all year, as well as some issues like we saw last night, back end of the bullpen there. We'll have a lot to get into as we continue on the show, go into some NFL headlines, because there were a lot of them that broke late yesterday. We'll break them all down next on the Lombardi Line. Our 2024 VSiN College Football Betting Guide is available now, and this guide is your ultimate resource for the upcoming college football season, including previews of all 134 teams, a preseason top 25, power ratings, proven betting systems, and more. Sign up now and receive both the college football and NFL betting guides, plus full VSiN Pro access to our daily pro picks, 24/7 video, exclusive data like our betting splits all the way through the Super Bowl at an early bird discount price of just $175. Or sign up on a monthly subscription. Get your first 30 days for only $19 to see everything VSiN has to up your betting game. Do not miss out on these preseason deals. Visit vsin.com/subscribe to sign up today. That is vsin.com/subscribe. A lot to get to today on the Friday edition of the Lombardi Line. We'll be tracking a lot of the Olympic action as it gets underway. Keep you posted there. Break down some of the Saturday action as well, in addition to all of our NFL talk. You made a wager on an underdog. Final men's semi that's about to start here. Novak Djokovic versus Lorenzo Musetti. You're intrigued. And the dog here, who's been good on clay in the past, the Italian.
I think he's been very good on clay, and he's been playing very well here the last couple of weeks. And I just think, you know, this version of Djokovic is not what we saw 2 years ago or maybe even last year, but he's gotten his way through. You know, he actually up a set, but down a break in the second, was a dog in play to Tsitsipas for one game yesterday, then came back and got the break back and won in straight sets. But he's like vulnerable. You know, he got to go through Nadal at the end. And I just think Musetti's playing better tennis right now, and at that plus price, +155, I would take a little shot.
And that opened in a lot of spots around 2-1. A lot of interest on the dog. We said you also don't get the advantage of the best of five in men's tennis. So you don't have the Djokovic angle of, well, he can just outlast him.
He can
with
drop the first.
The stamina.
And he'd be fine.
Yeah, there's no 4.5-hour matches here. Alcaraz on the other side of the draw. Carlos Alcaraz of Spain just destroys Felix Auger-Aliassime of Canada. 1-1 today. As a big, big favorite. So Alcaraz awaits the winner there in the gold medal match this weekend. Okay, to the NFL, where after we got off the air yesterday, Mike, you were in studio with Michael Lombardi and I, a lot of news comes out, the most pressing of which, from a long-term perspective, even though he's expected to be back by the start of the regular season, is Charger quarterback Justin Herbert, week to week with a plantar fascia injury to the right foot of Justin Herbert. Likely not going to see him at all in the preseason. Now the question becomes, how close to 100% will he be for the regular season? And not only that, Mike, it's with a new coach, new system, Jim Harbaugh coming in. How many reps, how confident will they feel in Herbert being fully integrated in that system come week one?
Well, he's still going to be there, but not get the physical reps. I don't know that it's that significant, other than that maybe there's a lingering effect for the first week, possibly, that week one game. It's funny because on Tuesday I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said, look, no one's ever gone back-to-back-to-back. I'm just taking a stand to fade the Chiefs this year. And I'm going to bet some exactas at Circa, but no Chiefs. I'm not putting the Chiefs. And And I said, but they're going to have, you know, they're going to win the division and you know, what are they going to be? They're going to be a two seed maybe. I mean, they're probably not going to have to play a road game till the end if they have to at all. I mean, can you ignore the fact that I think the division is very weak? And he's trying to make an argument maybe the Chargers could challenge him in the division. And then here comes, this is the Chargers can't win the division because Herbert has a foot issue for probably 2 to 3 weeks. I'm not saying that, but it just kind of lines up to them to, all right, let's get to January and see if the Chiefs can do it again.
100%. Of all the divisions in the NFL, Mike, to me, the largest delta between team one to team two is the AFC West.
How about from team two to team three?
You could
from
make
the
that
Chargers
same case.
To the Raiders or Broncos. Many people think the Broncos are the worst team in football. We've had a half dozen guests come on here and say that they were. I think it's New England, but they think that this Bronco team could be really bad. Obviously, Michael disagrees with that, but I mean, this is a division along with the NFC East that I think you can go 1, 2, 3, 4 like a superfecta.
Sure.
Like I think you could go very easily. You could go Kansas City, LA, I always say San Diego, Chargers, and then Raiders, and then Broncos, the way you could go Eagles, Cowboys, Commanders, mm-hmm. And then Giants. I just think there's clear delineation, and there's not any muddling of one of these teams that's a 3-4 win the division,
right,
or anything like
I'm
that.
I'm with you. I think where it gets a little more, there's been some disagreement in the market is, I think it's kind of consistent that the Chargers are that second power-rated team in the AFC West, but it's, how good are they? And the assumption, everything I've heard from people high on the Chargers is, well, as long as there's an adult in the room, now that Jim Harbaugh's there, that's automatically going to take LA immediately to another level. I push back on that by saying, look at the roster. I mean, this is still a defense that is in complete shambles. It's a bottom 10 front seven, bottom 10 secondary, young players all over the place that isn't going to just by week one naturally look like a playoff contender. And while the offensive line is very, very good with when Herbert returns to being fully healthy, you have a lot of confidence that they'll keep him upright. At the same time, Mike, I look at where they're at running back, wide receiver room, especially with how much they struggled to get production out of their young players last year that they invested in. It's not a situation where I just automatically expect Herbert to put up giant numbers, at least right away. So I'm further down, I'd say, on the Chargers than most simply because of how long it takes in the NFL. Just because you have the name doesn't mean week one, week two, you're completely all things are put together for a playoff contender.
I'm torn about betting this win total over. And the reason is, when you go back, and it's so far removed that I think it's not in the front of people's minds what a quick turnaround Harbaugh had at San Francisco. I mean, they were awful for 10 years. Singletary to Tom Sula, and they didn't make the play. And he comes in and goes championship game, championship game, championship game, right, and a Super Bowl with Kaepernick and Alex Smith. I mean, everywhere he went, to Stanford and San Diego, I mean, the turnarounds were quick, right? The other part, the devil on the other shoulder that says don't make the bet also says he's got a long leash here. I mean, there's going to be any heat on Jim Harbaugh if he wins 7 or 8 games or even 6 games this year, right? He's going to be given time to turn this program around, and I don't think he has to necessarily make decisions to win today. I think he builds a program. I agree with Michael. He gets them tougher at the line on both sides of the ball. So I really thought this total would settle at 9. Because of all the love for the Harbaugh move. And it's come to 8.5, and it's sort of stayed there. So I wouldn't lean under. I have thought about going over here just because I think they win 3 out of the other 4 games in the division other than the Chiefs.
In the strength of schedule, by far the easiest of anybody in the division.
Would they finish last year 5-12?
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that it ran off the rails that much.
Fourth place schedule.
Yeah.
Part of that is, what do you do in games like Carolina, right? The classic spot where the Chargers have traditionally struggled, that early 1 p.m. Eastern start time, especially week 2 now, cross-country trip. But it does set up really nicely for them. I'd say the biggest pushback to the Chargers on the scheduling front is the rest edges, where they have a lot of weeks where their opponents have rest advantages. And that's indicated by the fact there are 2 different Monday night games. So you'll have a couple of games, albeit against NFC South teams that are on short weeks this year for LA. But 8.5, that's where it's settled in. We have not seen it push up yet to 9, even though those 8.5s juiced heavily to the over at -155. The other quarterback piece from the news angle that, at least as of this morning, Mike, seemed to have been cleared up a little bit. There are reports that come out yesterday that quarterback Geno Smith for Seattle, he'd been banged up, a couple different injuries, knee, hip were the reports from ESPN. They were getting imaging on him. The report from this morning is that from Adam Schefter, those injuries not at all serious whatsoever. Mike McDonald, the new head coach there, had downplayed him a little bit. But at the very least, not a great sign that Geno's already banged up a little bit when you consider how bad his offensive line is. And to me, that's the biggest single question for Seattle, a team I'm very high on. But they'll need to develop that O-line to keep Smith upright and give them some success this year in a tough division.
I'm bullish on them, too. I think they were a team right on the edge last year. And maybe they got a little tired of Pete's voice in the locker room. And they needed a new look. I mean, you have to give a lot of credit to McDonald, what he did with the Baltimore defense over a couple of years, transforming it into a top three unit in the game. I actually took a small piece of them to make the playoffs is the way I bet Seattle. I didn't do anything with the win total, but I thought it was a sexy price. I bet it at plus 185. And an NFC that's kind of, I think, muddling after you take a look at the top four teams, which I consider the top four teams to be San Francisco, Green Bay, Detroit, and Philadelphia. I don't even put Dallas in
I do too.
I'm just
look, I have Dallas five, yeah. But I'm not completely selling the Cowboys just because they haven't done anything in the offseason. That is a classic overblown story of media and the Dallas, you know, the Dallas thing we talk about every year because people want to see them make big splashes. But there's certainly going to be those final two spots well up for grabs as far as, and even though it might only be one spot because you have two teams in those top four we just mentioned in the same division with Green Bay and Detroit. But Seattle is going to be live. And Mike McDonald, to me, very intriguing coach of the year candidate who's sitting there in the 20-1 range, especially because of the pieces they already have on defense. And I rank both their front seven and secondary clearly in the top half of the league, Mike. And that's before you even get into the development we've seen with McDonald as a defensive mind over the years. It really just comes down to now with, you know, a new OC coming in, and Seattle has a lot of change there. And the Seahawks will have Ryan Grubb now calling the plays on offense. What can they get? Can Geno Smith return to being a top 10 quarterback that we have seen statistically in his first year in Seattle?
Looking at the NFC championship odds, who do you think Circa's biggest liability in the Super Bowl market from the NFC is?
Philly?
No.
Not Philly. Detroit?
No. Eventually you'll get to your Packers.
Green Bay would be my third choice. Okay. A lot of Packer love this year.
A lot of Packer love.
Wow.
A lot of money for love.
A lot of money for that love as well. We're going to talk some AFC when we come back. Houston Texans are up, and it's Texans beat reporter Jonathan Alexander who joins us on the Lombardi Line right after this.
This is the Lombardi Line with Stormy Bonatoni and Mike Palm on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
We're underway on our Friday edition of the Lombardi Line from downtown Las Vegas, Circa Sportsbook Studio with Mike Palm. I'm Ben Wilson. Excited to be with you, Mike. Next couple of days here as we are now into preseason football. We expect to see some lines, wouldn't you say? Probably next couple of days, lines out for week one of the preseason?
Yeah, I think so. They'll be posted no later than tomorrow afternoon.
Okay, good stuff. Next Thursday, we'll get into a full docket of week one preseason. We had the one game underway last night, even though it didn't complete. But we did see at least a quarter and two quarters and a half or so on the Hall of Fame game. And we'll talk some Houston Texans football right now as we go out to our progressive guest line. He was in Canton last night, covers the team for the Houston Chronicle. Jonathan Alexander at John M. Alexander joins us right now. Thank you so much. Appreciate the time. As far as the game, we actually did see, I think the most intriguing part for all of us was watching how the kickoffs were all playing out here. From actually being there in person and from what you had talked to coaches about their expectations, how did what we saw on the field actually jive with some of the expectations and some of the things coaches have talked about as it relates to this new kickoff rule this year?
Yeah, I think there was a lot that the coaching staff didn't know how things would shake out, but they had studied it all this offseason. I think what they didn't realize and what they realized from Thursday night's game is that there were still a lot of violent hits there. You know, the NFL really created this to increase player safety and also get more kick returns, but I think players still got hurt. Like, in particular, Texans linebacker Jake Hansen suffered what appeared to be a head injury on one of the kickoffs. I think there were still some kinks to work out. A couple of player movement, illegal movement violations on the kick return from the Texans. But I think that there will still be some concerns moving forward because it didn't look like it slowed down the collisions that happened on the kick return.
Jonathan, I want to ask you a question about the defensive side of the ball for the Texans. and particularly the tackles. They lose two very good tackles in Collins and Rankins. How are they going to replace them this year on the defensive front?
Yeah, they feel like they went out and added more depth by adding pieces like Mario Edwards, who's a versatile defender who could play defensive end and defensive tackle. Danico Autry, who was one of the best at it, but recently was suspended for 6 games. He was certainly in their plans. And then they added other pieces like Fale Fatukante, who has experience playing in D'Amico's system, having played with the Jets under Robert Saleh, and then Tim Settle. But they're definitely going to have a drop-off. Sheldon Rankins would, in my opinion, would be considered a top 10 defensive tackle. Malik Collins, probably top 20. So there's definitely a drop-off, but I think the thinking from the Texans was that Collins in particular didn't fit D'Amico's system as much as the players that they brought in. And they think that by adding more pieces and having guys you can rotate, they'll be a lot fresher and guys come in and attack all opposing offenses as much as they would like.
He's Jonathan Alexander joining us right now, breaking down the Houston Texans from the Houston Chronicle right now on the Lombardi Line. In a similar fashion to Jonathan, this is a pass defense 20th in the NFL on an EPA per play basis last year. We clearly saw a drop-off in production from Jimmy Ward, who was more brought in to be one of those veteran presence guys coming over, had played for D'Amico Ryans previously in San Francisco. What's the thought now as far as development, where you've seen Derek Stingley struggle with injury so far as a bright young piece of that secondary? What is the outlook for a secondary that was exposed at times last year for Houston?
Yeah, absolutely. I think injuries were a big deal for the Texans. They didn't have a nickel cornerback as well. They used Jimmy Ward at nickel a lot, and Jimmy, I think, is 33. So they've kind of switched things up. They're going to use Jalen Petrie at nickel now, and that's what Jalen Petrie did at Baylor. They also added some pieces to their secondary. They drafted Kamari Lassiter in the second round out of Georgia, and to be honest, Kamari Lassiter has been one of the more impressive players in camp. He's locked down some of the best wide receivers on this team. He's gone up against Stephon Diggs, Nico Collins, and Tank Dell, and he's making plays consistently, so they believe they've gotten better there. Of course, Jalen Petrie is entering year 3, so he should be improved. He struggled a little bit last year, and having him play going back and forth between nickel and safety should definitely help. So they think they've improved and gotten better in areas. And then, of course, Derek Stingley, he had the year he had when he was healthy, 5 interceptions, which was 4th in the league, despite missing 6 games. And they think if he can stay healthy, he can be a superstar.
I want to talk about, Jonathan, the mentality of the team and how Nico takes this team into year 2 from being the hunter to the hunted. We talk about all the games but one in that early window, that 1 o'clock Eastern window, and the schedule. The schedule is very difficult. When you look at Jacksonville division champs 2 years ago, they went 1-4 against the 5 other division champs last year and 2-5 against the teams with winning records. The Texans this year have to play 11 teams with winning records on their schedules. What's your overall outlook for them moving forward in terms of season win total sits at 9.5 and a division championship?
Yeah, you bring up a great point. They have one of the most difficult schedules in the NFL, and you look at that later stretch where they play the Ravens, the Chiefs, and slipping my mind, but I think the Dolphins, all in a 10-day span. That's going to be difficult for them. But what the Texans tried to do to mitigate that was by adding crucial pieces. They got better. They added Stephon Diggs to this roster. So that wide receiver core is really good. They added Danielle Hunter on defense. They added Joe Mixon as a running back. They felt like they added a lot of strong pieces to make this team better to be able to compete with some of these top teams down the stretch. But there's no question about it. It's going to be a tough schedule. And I'm predicting them to win about 10 games, go 10-7. I think what will help the other teams in the AFC South, particularly the Jaguars, is they don't have such a tough schedule. I don't think that the Colts got a ton better. They brought back a lot of their pieces, but I don't think they got a ton better. But there's no doubt I think the Texans have the best talent in the AFC South.
Crucially, too, we'll get extra rest for those Week 10 games against the Lions, the Week 17 game against the Baltimore Ravens. That is very important with how tough the schedule is for Houston here as we're talking with Jonathan Alexander on our progressive guest line. It's unquestioned now. You talk about the wide receiver additions. I mean, it's a legit top five unit. You have CJ Stroud. I mean, he ascended. You're pushing back, Mike? You don't think the Texans are a top five?
I think they have too many guys that want the ball.
Well,
that's what I think. How do you spread the ball? And that's a good question for Jonathan as I steal your question.
No. It's all good.
You bring in Diggs, right? And you've already got Nico Collins. Tank Dell was terrific. Mm-hmm. Just absolutely terrific. You've got Dalton Schultz and now Joe Mixon. That's a lot of guys that want the ball. How do they spread it around in this offense, Jonathan?
I think that's more than a fair question. It's a question that I've asked. I think the good thing about the Texans is that Tank Dell and Nico Collins have already proven to be unselfish players. I think they understand the talent that Diggs brings. So I don't think those two will be complaining. I do think Stephon Diggs is the wild card. We know that he likes to get the ball. It'll be interesting to see how he responds if there are some games where he doesn't get a ton of targets. But I think C.J. Stroud also has a ton of experience in this. He played with a lot of great wide receivers when he was at Ohio State. Chris Olave, Garrett Wilson, Jaxon Smith-Njigba, Marvin Harrison, all on the same team, and all of them found ways to still shine. And I think the more you can create that unselfish culture, and I think they brought this point to Stephon Diggs before he was traded, that this is a team that will spread the ball around and that he can't have that type of mentality to succeed in this type of offense. I think they get it, and I think they'll be mindful of that. And I think they all know that there will be games where there might be a person who won't get as many targets as they would like. So, I think that they're aware of it, so I think they'll be able to handle it.
We saw tons of offensive linemen last year, Jonathan, have to get cycled through because of injury. We also saw OC Bobby Sloak at times struggle with being predictable, second highest rate of run pass sequencing of anybody in the NFL. What are your expectations from Sloak's perspective, assuming now the offensive line is a little bit more fortified here as far as the play calling and more development and growth there for the offense?
Yeah, they really got to stay healthy on the offensive line, and they have been healthy, fairly healthy, pretty much on the interior with Juice Scruggs and Kenyon Green, who missed a lot of time last year. Laremy Tunsil at left tackle is coming back from an injury. They just hope they can get some consistency there and not have to deal with the injuries that they dealt with. But that was one of the issues for Bobby Sloak as far as the predictability. And I think he started to learn that towards the end of the year, where he started to change up how he did his runs and passes instead of just running, and then pass. He started to change it up. And I think he's a smart guy. He learns from his mistakes, and I think they'll be more purposeful. I think they also have a more effective running game if Joe Mixon can be healthy. I think Damian Pierce will also be a little improved this year. He doesn't really fit the scheme that Bobby Sloak employs, but I think he's done a great job in trying to fix the mistakes that he made last year. And then Joe Mixon, he knows how to play in this offense. He's had success. So I think they'll be a little bit better prepared this year.
A lot of excitement around the Houston Texans in 2024. Division favorites there in the AFC South. A pleasure speaking with Jonathan Alexander from the Houston Chronicle. Give him a follow at John M. Alexander. Really appreciate the time, man. Great insights on the Texans this year.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
We will have more NFL to talk about in a little bit on the show, Mike. But up next, Olympics. We're down to the home stretch. Men's basketball into the final group stage game tomorrow. We'll get a discussion on that. Also, what to expect Olympic women's soccer quarterfinals tomorrow morning. We'll break it all down on the Lombardi line after this.
This is the Lombardi line with Stormy Bonatoni and Mike Palm on VSIN, the sports betting network.
Right now on our website, VSiN.com, Adam Burke with his Major League Baseball best bets for this loaded Friday card. We also have all sorts of Olympic coverage. Zach Cohen breaking down the Olympic basketball and the tennis every single day. As we're underway now, second semifinal on the men's side. On serve early between Novak Djokovic and Lorenzo Musetti. There with a match against Carlos Alcaraz in the gold medal match on the line. Iga Swiatek did win the bronze earlier today, Mike.
I saw that.
Huge favorite to win the gold. She did not.
Yeah.
Shock upset.
I think Gil had Coco and Iga meeting in the final. I think he had the Iga Coco exacta. Didn't get there.
How many people had the Quinwen Zhang Donavekic exacta?
Nobody. It was a field. Field exacta.
Field exacta. Yeah.
Fetchich, but no, it's been good. And The men's draw has been interesting. I thought maybe Alcaraz could will Nadal a little further along in the doubles. It wasn't to be.
Similar with Andy Murray retiring after, and Dan Evans couldn't will him along either. Although we're Dan Evans, Carlos Alcaraz, slightly different on the scale. Alas, Olympics, a really good weekend too as we get into some of the knockout rounds for the women's soccer front, U.S. taking on Japan. Also, we'll have our final group stage matches for the men's basketball. That's tomorrow morning, 11:15 a.m. Eastern time, USA taking on Puerto Rico. Giant favorites, as you would expect, Mike, within that respective match. The thing I couldn't believe, though, are some of these odds now on the Olympic MVP, because through two games, and this really started when the U.S. narrowly beat South Sudan, the final tune-up in the preseason exhibitions, is a 43.5-point favorite winning by one. But LeBron James at even money to win MVP for the team. Granted, you're baking in, like, Kevin Durant's 4-1 and was very, very solid in the first game against Serbia. But those are two games where the U.S. was always winning comfortably, up by double digits the whole way, as evidenced by Bam Adebayo being the leading scorer in game number two against South Sudan. What am I missing on LeBron on a team that's minus 600, and yet you have LeBron James, who has been the face of the U.S. men's team, his final Olympics, even money to win MVP, assuming the U.S. were to win the gold?
Well, what price would you be willing to lay, young Ben? Because you're suggesting that's ludicrous to get even money.
I would have thought minus 150, honestly.
Okay, well, like that's move all in here. Double up.
Make the bet. I will make the bet.
He will this team to the gold. I mean, this is more important to him than anyone. You have to understand these guys have national brands. He's worried about a global brand. Very few basketball players worried about a global brand. You can count them on two fingers, Jordan and LeBron. I'm not betting even money here, but if you think it's a great price, take your shot.
Look, Kevin Durant could outscore LeBron James, which he has the first two games by a combined 4 points. And you would still think James would get the medal, assuming he's in the mix. He's gotten the most minutes.
Who's voting? Do we know who the voters are, or is this like the WNBA, where it's all in secrecy?
I feel like when it comes to things involving the IOC, there's a good amount of secrecy. That's a fair assumption to make, would you say?
I like it's interesting that FIFA's controlling what happens in the soccer. There, you know what I mean? It's they're their own organization that outweighs anything the IOC has to say. You can't even really appeal to the IOC when you're with the droning incident. It's totally in FIFA's hands for the women. But meanwhile,
FIFA, IOC, just bastions of
integrity and across transparency.
The board. USA 35-point favorites on the men's side. So look, we're not close to covering in either game against the South Sudanese. That game went all the way down to the 30 range. Are we really to believe that
it closed to 29 here?
Yeah. 29. Yeah. Are we really to believe? And South Sudan, who beat Puerto Rico already in the group stage, U.S. has come out. Now, who knows how much you want to take this at face value, but head coach Steve Kerr saying we want to put a beat down on Puerto Rico here to kind of, you know, sort of reading between the lines, he essentially illuminated to we want to put in a really good big-time winning effort here to get us with as much momentum as possible going into the quarterfinal. Are we really to believe that, I guess power ratings-wise, because South Sudan beat Puerto Rico by a narrow margin, we're just saying, oh, yeah, U.S., Puerto Rico about 6 points worse than South Sudan. That's what will make the line. That really fair? I mean, it kind of seems like we're just guessing on all this stuff when it comes to these Olympic lines.
Well, we are. It's like exhibition college basketball at the start of the year when I was playing Slippery Rock. I mean, what number do you put up? It's very difficult to gauge when there's that much separation between the teams. I was a little surprised Greece beat Australia this morning. I watched a lot of that game. I got up at 3 a.m. because I wanted to watch the women's 100, the eight qualifying legs, which I think is the most fascinating part of this whole Olympics, is the women's track and field. So it's fortunate, the timing. But they said they're going to run. It'll be later in the day tomorrow, the semis and the finals. Hopefully that we can see tomorrow night. But I have to check the timing. Obviously, all three American women moved on. Sharika Jackson won her heat, fourth fastest time or fifth fastest, but she had it shut down. She had it shut down with about 30 meters to go. T.T. Terry won. Shelly Ann Fraser-Pryce in her fifth Olympics at the age of 36. This is her farewell for Jamaica. Two golds and two bronze medals for her. 08, 12, 16, and 21. Think about that as a sprinter now in your fifth Olympics. Yeah. I was very impressed with the Canadian, Audrey Leduc, who I think ran the second fastest qualifying time. MJ Talou from the Ivory Coast. I believe she's been fourth in the last two Olympics. Mm. She easily won her heat. And the girl Naita from Great Britain. I think it would be very fascinating. And obviously, you know, a lot of the favorites, you could bet these different heats, these different, you could bet who was going to win them. A lot of the favorites were $3 and $4 favorites. Now, as we get into the semifinals and finals, you'll have a lot more betting value. I don't think you're going to see negative numbers on anyone, including Sharika Jackson.
And you would think too, the betting interest, especially for an event like this, will go up. It's one of the, you guys are going to be offering.
Yep.
So it makes it very, very enticing as we get into the gold medal rounds. Also tomorrow morning, U.S. Women's Soccer takes on Japan. I saw Japan in person a few years ago at the Women's World Cup. Was impressed with their defense, but at that time, the Japanese women's national team just, you know, not much to really be feared about as far as the attacking the final third. I watched them play England in Nice a few years ago at the Women's World Cup. They take on the U.S. U.S. big favorites here to bet. Just updating the odds screen here to bet U.S. to win in regulation time would be minus 155. And you have to say, kind of getting the stink of the previous, the Olympic shambolic failure behind the U.S., it's kind of felt fresh. They've looked a little more susceptible, wouldn't you say, Mike, at the back? But it hasn't mattered because the finishing ability of a Trinity Rodman and some of the other key pieces in the final third have been really impressive for the U.S. So no reason to believe, in my thought at least, that they will get scared here by Japan.
Not Japan. Did you make a bet for gold at all in women's soccer?
No, I didn't.
No.
I felt like I should. I felt like the bet would have been before because there was admittedly uncertainty on the U.S. women's team. New coach coming in, but as soon as the way they looked solid early, it seems like that price kind of got away.
And this game against Australia, they probably could have scored 4 or 5 goals. I mean, they ended up sticking on the 2, and then Australia gets one late on kind of the broken play in the box. But no, I think they've been in control. What was the best price you could have gotten pre-tournament on them?
I think it was in the 3-1 range. I mean, they're +160 right now. Spain is still the slight favorite. What is more telling to me will be how the U.S. looks against Japan. Against Japan, it was in the same group as Spain, and Spain really dominated that game, although Japan did score off Spain's excellent defense. 2-1 win for Spain. Japan had to do it the hard way. They've won back-to-back matches. So based on the peer comparison there, Mike, we'll feel, I'd say, a little bit more confident about how that U.S. matchup with Spain would look moving forward toward a potential gold medal match were it to play out that way. Also, women's basketball-wise, a relatively comfortable win over Belgium by 13 points. U.S. will take on Germany this weekend. That is Sunday morning final group stage matchup as well. Asia Wilson now the minus 120 MVP favorite. And an interesting comment, if nothing else, from Dawn Staley talking about the selection process, because we've notably not seen any of Caitlin Clark yet. Ratings still have been very, very good for the women's national team. Here's what Dawn Staley had to say about a very polarizing topic on Olympic sports.
There's so much conversation about women's basketball, the run South Carolina had to the national championship, a perfect season. Obviously, Caitlin Clark. And there was so much conversation on, should Caitlin be on the U.S. women's national team? You were part of the selection group. Mm-hmm. Give me your read on that now that we've got a little bit of time and we can get into some clear air to see what happened.
Right. When as a committee member, you're charged with putting together best team of players, the best talent. Caitlin is just a rookie in the WNBA, wasn't playing bad, but wasn't playing like she's playing now. If we had to do it all over again, the way that she's playing, she would be in really high consideration of making the team because she is playing head and shoulders above a lot of people, shooting the ball extremely well. I mean, she is an elite passer. She's just got a great basketball IQ, and she's a little more seasoned in the pro game.
In a couple of months.
Yeah, she was 2 months ago.
That's great perspective to add there.
You buy that if it was 5 more games, say, for Caitlin Clark, she'd be on the
team?
She's
not shooting the ball very well. She's exposed herself as the great passer that she is. I mean, Rebecca Lobo said she's the best passer in the WNBA already. First it was she didn't go to the tryouts, she didn't go through the process. Then it was she never played with those players before. The excuse is a different one every week. But I don't buy the fact that the committee is only concerned with gold and not marketing a league that's lost money 25 straight years. David Stern put Rebecca Lobo on the team. Go watch the documentary Dream On about the 96 Olympics.
Great doc.
He needed eyes. He needed households to start that league. He needed the exposure. They could have had it here.
Could have. 11 games in 20 days for Clark to start the WNBA career. That's what they have based it all on. That's 1 hour in the books here on the Lombardi Line. We'll revisit some of the top headlines in the NFL when we come back.